I'm your host, Brent Metcalf. Let's talk Mormon Studies. Today we have a special guest on the podcast who I think is a remarkable gift to Mormon studies, and in particular to Mormon scriptural studies. David Bakavoy has published in a variety of academic journals. He has a bachelor's degree from Brigham Young University with a major in history and a minor in Near Eastern studies. He has a master's degree on top of that in Near Eastern Studies and Judaic Studies from Brandeis University. And to top off the icing on the cake, he has a PhD in Hebrew Bible and the ancient Near East. David is a prolific blogger, as well as someone who comments frequently on a variety of issues on his Facebook page and other social media. And he has contributed enormously to our understanding of LDS scripture. His most recent publication is Authoring the Old Testament, Genesis to Deuteronomy, which is going to be part of a three-volume set discussing the authorship of the Hebrew scriptures. And with that, I welcome David. It's an honor to have you here, my friend.
Brent, you are so kind. Thank you for that very generous introduction. And I am so excited about this new project of yours. It's a great privilege to be on with you. And you have my full support and grateful for this chance to visit. Thank you.
Well, you're very kind. And you're someone who I've followed over the years. A very dear friend of mine was one of your professors at Brandeis,
yes.
David Wright. And I've become very interested in the path that you've taken. And one of the things I wanted to get to before we get into some of the different topics is, can you describe for listeners some of the projects and teaching projects that you're working on at the University of Utah?
Oh, good. Sure. So the past 3 years, I've had the opportunity to teach at the University of Utah as part of their new religious studies program. I've taught Biblical Hebrew, the language, taught a course on sex in the Bible, which was, of course, provocative and interesting to a lot of students.
No doubt.
And survey of Hebrew Bible, historical figure of Jesus in a first century Jewish context. And then for Mormon studies, I've had the opportunity to teach for 2 semesters now the Book of Mormon as literature, which has been a wonderful experience. Most of the students have been LDS, and in that LDS group have had really 2 different types of students, those who come from a very traditional believing background, who I think perhaps at least initially were interested in the class to, out of perhaps even some concern as to how a course like this would be taught in an academic context, exploring a scriptural text that they feel so devoted to religiously. And then there were others of an LDS background who perhaps, less believing or very humanistic in their interpretation of the Book of Mormon and its origins, with a similar concern, but from the exact opposite angle. You know, is this a class that will be designed to promote Mormonism and convert students to LDS scripture and its truth claims?
That's a really interesting take because, I think about other religious traditions, even coming down to evangelical Christians and Jewish traditions. This is something not new to them. Mm-hmm. This is something that I think has been taught in their institutions of higher learning for decades and perhaps even much longer. But I think that this is something that is new for a Mormon audience. And so how have you approached that in a way that is accessible, but at the same time deals with important issues and critical issues in terms of scholarship and what the most recent scholarship of literary and historical criticism has to offer.
Well, it's been an exciting challenge, but a challenge nonetheless, because of course students have strong feelings. Some of the students have been non-LDS and interested in taking the class to learn about the text in a safe environment, which is what the Academy presents. It's a chance to learn and to promote understanding without the goal of conversion or deconversion. And that final point is one that I have stressed repeatedly in teaching the class, is that my goal is not to convert students to a specific form of Mormonism or even an acceptance of various truth claims of the Book of Mormon, nor is it to deconvert, but to learn to appreciate different ways of approaching the text and enjoying what it has to offer, because it is a remarkable book. And it can be appreciated from different angles. One of the primary approach that I take in the class is to simply bracket its claims for ancient authenticity and its meaning in terms of its translation and its production, and to simply follow the lead of Grant Hardy in his book, Understanding the Book of Mormon, published by Oxford University Press, where we just simply take the characters seriously and talk about, well, from a psychoanalytical perspective, their viewpoints, their ideas, what they seem to be conveying. But that's not the only approach that I illustrate or model. I also draw upon, well, Brent, your significant contributions to the field, Dan Vogel's, as you mentioned, my professor David Wright. My students recently just finished his wonderful essay on Isaiah in the Book of Mormon. We had a wonderful conversation on looking at the way that the King James Version and its italicized words have influenced the development of the text, without trying to make any sort of judgment as to what that has to say in terms of its authorship or its claims, but learning to appreciate the way the different scholars have approached that material from a literary perspective. And I've stressed to the students that I'm not asking them to buy into any specific model or viewpoint, but wherever they're coming from, whether a human, purely humanistic perspective, they can benefit from a literary approach that takes the character seriously, like Grant Hardy and others have offered. And if they are true believers, they still ought to understand the way that those who take a more humanistic approach to the text have analyzed it as literature, and understand and appreciate where different viewpoints have come and how they articulate the matter. And as I've expressed it that way, the student response has been overwhelmingly positive. It's been a remarkable experience, and the feedback has been, well, positive enough that the university has wanted to continue offering the course.
That's excellent. And I hope that this is a course that continues for many years to come. It's something that has been sorely needed. The fact is that I suspect that a lot of LDS students are being introduced to some concepts for the first time. I was looking at a website that's called thetorah.com recently, and I believe that one of your former professors is also involved in that project.
Yes.
Mark Brettler.
Mm-hmm, indeed.
It became very clear to me that within Judaism, there is a much greater tolerance, perhaps even comfort zone, for people to talk about very sensitive issues such as historicity of scripture and so on. There's a range of writers on that website, some of whom, for example, believe in the historicity of the Exodus narrative. Others seem to question that. Others who seem to have very serious doubts about the historicity of the patriarchal narratives about Abraham and Joseph and so on. And I think that Mormonism, as a very young faith, is only beginning to broach those questions in a capacity that goes beyond anti-Mormon literature that we've seen in the past. And now within the community of the faithful, there are people who are basically raising the scholarly bar and saying these are issues that we need to look at and take seriously, not as a mode to discount faith and to discount our scripture, but rather as a way, a new way perhaps, of appreciating the dynamics of our scripture. I know that there has been considerable debate going back and forth on issues of historicity and scripture, And I wanted to get you to offer some insight on historicity in scripture, how you define history versus historicity. Are they the same? Are they different? And kind of lead us down that path. And how would you introduce these topics to both an LDS and a non-LDS audience?
Well, I really appreciate the way you articulated these ideas on the development that we've seen recently in Mormon studies and taking less of an apologetic and, I would say, critical approach in the sense of criticizing those who have a non-traditional perspective on the development of the Book of Mormon. That was just so well articulated, Brent. And I just wanted to add, in fact, that the first semester I took the course, Earl Wunderly, the author of the book, An Imperfect Book, What the Book of Mormon Tells Us About Itself, he and his wife took the class, and I developed a great friendship with them. We drew upon some of his observations, and they've continued to, as a continuing adult students, take almost every class that I teach at the University of Utah. And I love that. I love that we can have open conversations on different viewpoints and perspectives and appreciate the contributions that various scholars have had to make over the years on these important topics. You're right, it is very much as we're progressing more, we're maturing more, becoming more open like Judaism has. And then to direct back then to your actual question on history and historicity, and I'll link that with the scholar that you mentioned. As a doctoral student, I had an opportunity to take I've took many courses from Mark Brettler, but one of my favorites that I took was on historicity and topics of historical analysis in the Hebrew Bible. Dr. Brettler is the author of the famous book, The Creation of History, and has had a lot to offer and say upon this topic. So my views, admittedly, when it comes to historicity and scripture, have not only academically, but I suspect even to some extent religiously and personally, have been influenced by his perspective. And for those who aren't familiar with Dr. Brettler, he's a very critical, famous Hebrew Bible scholar who is also a committed Orthodox Jew, devoted to his faith and his religious community.
That's what struck me on the website that he and his colleagues have developed, because you have kind of this coming together of both spiritual leaders, rabbis within the community, mm-hmm. as well as professors who are coming together and saying, let's talk seriously about our sacred texts.
Yes.
And let's try and understand them. And through that understanding, see what new vistas can be open to us in appreciating scripture for the human qualities it has, as well as its divine qualities. Mm-hmm. That, I think, is something that within the Mormon community, there hasn't been as much of a discussion of, because when it comes to historicity, let's face it, there was a recent article written by two inveterate Book of Mormon apologists who effectively made the comment that if a text claims to be historical and yet isn't, then you have three options. One, the author was mistaken. Two, the author was delusional. Or three, the author was a fraud. But aside from the fact that I think in that instance, that shows a remarkable lack of creativity in my mind in trying to interpret a text, it also has the effect of herding unwitting believers into a theological box canyon where they feel that the only escape is apostasy.
Yes.
Because you've given them no other option.
Exactly.
That's this very black and white view of the world. It's either authentic this way or it's inauthentic. And what I found fascinating was the almost equation of authentic history equals authentic scripture. Inauthentic history equals inauthentic scripture. Mm-hmm. And that seems to me to be just remarkably limiting, if not astoundingly naive, when you're looking at the biblical text, whether it's the Christian scriptures or the Hebrew scriptures.
Exactly.
There are issues of historicity and historical accuracy, and whether or not certain events even occurred historically throughout those works. And so, again, I find such a view so limiting. And I kind of want you to reflect on that.
It's an important issue, with, not only within Mormonism, but in all religious traditions, right? What is the distinction between historicity and authenticity, and what value does a text have if it is not historical? I'll just add that this view that sometimes creeps in with Mormonism, that unless a book is fundamentally historically accurate, it is really not of value as a spiritual record. I think that that is an inheritance from certain Protestant viewpoints that, as you've mentioned, are antithetical to a traditional Jewish way of looking at scripture that has existed for centuries, that we find not only in rabbinic writings, but very much a part of the New Testament sources itself. I guess to specify, when I discuss this, as I have on my blogs, and they've drawn a lot of attention, both positive and negative, when I use the term historicity, I use it in a way that's consistent with the way that Brettler and others have used the term in their research and publication. But it means the act of producing a work that attempts to depict an accurate representation of the real, authentic past. And we might distinguish that, as I do, between the word historicity versus historical. Historical is closely related to the concept of historicity, and yet it is very much distinct. Historical refers to something or even someone from the past. And so the analogy that I like to use is Jesus. Jesus was clearly a historical person, but the New Testament, without question, lacks historicity. And this is why scholars over the centuries have developed specific skills within critical scholarship to uncover who the historical Jesus is based upon, well, the gospel narratives that we have that present a past but do not necessarily represent the past correctly.
I think for Mormons, and tell me if you agree with this or not, that the artifacts, and we may even call them the props that Joseph Smith used during his translations, are things that create complexity for Mormons in discussing historicity. For example, the gold plates, the appearance of an angel, in some sources being referred to as Moroni, and at least one fairly prominent source being referred to as Nephi.
Yep.
Those things have all become issues for people, and those have become, I think, almost stumbling blocks in trying to understand the nature of historicity and the Book of Mormon and LDS scripture. When I look at it, and not to take us too far down another trail here, but I wonder why people don't recognize that there are cultural influences on all these elements that can't be ignored. When the angel appears to Joseph Smith, the angel appears three times during the night. That is something that was a common artifact, if you will, of the money diggers and the money digging experience, that when they had a dream that was repeated three times, that meant that the dream was true. So in other words, there's a cultural genre within which these things need to be analyzed, and you can't simply pick them out of that culture and say, well, what about this? This thing alone is going to cause me to challenge you on your questions that you may have about the historicity of the document, when those founding events themselves belong to cultural genres, cultural elements, and should be considered in that context as well.
Very well said. In fact, I would build on that then, Brent, and say that there are two different ways, of course, of taking that sort of information seriously. One is for those who would adopt a humanistic perspective of it and just simply and be fascinated with the way that Joseph Smith is influenced religiously, theologically, and in his visionary experiences in terms of his culture. And those of us who take a religious and devotional approach to those experiences, we too should be able to appreciate the fact that these are cultural elements that have influenced the way that Joseph Smith, or whomever the visionary is, has experienced the divine, or at least the way that the visionary has articulated his or her experience with the divine. And there's something to be gained from that from both angles, whether those who want to take it just purely from an academic perspective and don't necessarily believe in a religious connection with that, that they are inspired by themselves personally, but those who have a religious connection. I think that there is something to be said for learning this, or accepting, I should say, perhaps this idea that God works within language, culture, and, you know, viewpoints and perspectives that are, they're specific to that time period and that individual's cultural milieu.
I think that that's the key right there, David. And that is that irrespective of whether you come to the LDS faith and the foundational events of the LDS faith as a believer or a non-believer in an academic sense, I think that we can both appreciate that if you do take seriously the faith claims and you are a believer, that you can begin to appreciate that somehow this should communicate something to you about the way in which God interacts with humans. And that is in a very cultural way. On the one hand, he interacts with humans in a way that is something within their cultures, but on another, there is something where it gets lifted above their cultures in the way they experience God in a way that's unique to them. That's something that even as a non-believer myself, I can feel comfortable in discussing because it's something that I think adheres to the historical evidence the best way that I can communicate with believer and non-believer alike.
Yes.
Your book series that you're doing on the authorship of the Old Testament, I know that historicity is bound to come up.
Mm-hmm.
I'm curious, for example, if you took the archaeological evidence and looking at Joshua and Judges versus Judges on the Israelite conquest narratives, how would something like that figure into your discussion of historicity, the historical versus historicity?
Maybe to set that up, we should explore for just a second why I feel so passionately about making statements such as the Bible lacks historicity and we shouldn't approach it as a text that is attempting to present to us an accurate portrayal of the past. And to do that, I would maybe set it up this way and talk about the fact that historians, in a contemporary sense, cannot repeat the past. All that we can do is base our assessment on evidence that shows us what most likely transpired. And from this angle, history in the modern academy is not science, right? History is simply a matter of evidence-based probabilities. Perhaps we could consider it from this angle. Science uses evidence to predict what will happen under a certain of when certain factors come together, but history postdicts what has occurred based upon evidence. And so then the question is asked, well, what constitutes evidence for the historian? And that's a question of methodology. How does a historian establish reasonable probability that an event occurred or that a figure from the past, whether it's Abraham, Moses, Nephi, Jesus, Julius Caesar, whomever, right, that this person really existed? We have to have sources for that, sources of information. We'd like to have hard physical evidence, perhaps a contemporary inscription with a person's name on it, or maybe surviving products that can be traced with some certainty back to the person's name, or that he or she has produced, maybe something that Abraham himself wrote. But without that, we're really just relying upon literary remains, okay? And that is that's important to understand. So the goal of the historian is to try and tell us something about the past based upon evidence. And I think that the New Testament scholar Bart Ehrman does such a wonderful job in his popularly written books on the New Testament describing what the modern historian does as opposed to the ancient historian. And he discusses this idea that really, the historian cannot use miracles as a basis by which to understand the past, because that runs contrary to the craft of the modern historian. And whether we're talking a miracle or something from the supernatural, such as Jesus' resurrection or Moses' parting of the Red Sea or Joseph Smith's conversations with Moroni, these are miracles. And Ehrman does a wonderful job in his work, from my perspective at least, explaining that the very definition of a miracle is something that is beyond the evidence for us to establish as something that is likely occurred. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it's something beyond empiricism. It's beyond empirical evidence.
Yes.
The gold plates would be a classic example to me, because in that case, the gold plates don't behave like a typical document in any way, shape, or form. For example, after Joseph Smith loses the 116 pages and the gold plates are taken from him, then they're returned to him again. He writes in his 1832 history that he was then contacted by a young man who turned out to be Oliver Cowdery, who was going to come and write for him. But he also comments and says that the Lord had appeared to Cowdery and had showed him the plates. But presumably, the plates were in the possession of Joseph Smith at the time. And so this is a document, presumably from antiquity, that doesn't behave like other documents that we know about from antiquity. So when we go to the Book of Abraham Papyri, for example, they're simply these static, real-world documents that sit there. People can come in and view them. When they later get sold to various museums, portions of them are actually destroyed in a fire, and unbelievers and non-believers can see this document. That's not the case with the gold plates. The gold plates behave in a fundamentally different way. And so where do you go to try and find the evidence that you're going to make to say that the gold plates actually function as an empirical artifact when they have these otherworldly properties that we can't assign to what we would identify as a regular, everyday empirical artifact? Does that make sense?
Yes, I think that's very well expressed, and I absolutely agree with it. And that doesn't mean that there weren't golden plates. It doesn't mean that Jesus did not walk on water or that Moses did not part the Red Sea. It means that if those miracles happened, they are beyond the ability of the historian to make clear as something that probably took place in the past, because miracles are events that we deem virtually impossible. That's what the term miracle means. And the goal of the historian is to explain what most likely occurred in the past. And, you know, as miracles by their very nature are always the least probable explanation for what took place. It doesn't matter if we believe them or not. If they weren't a miracle, then it would just be something odd or strange that occurred. I think that's important for Latter-day Saints to recognize, and it's one of my concerns with traditional Mormon apologetic efforts, we're using the wrong tools to assess Scripture and its value when we try to analyze this material according to the modern contemporary historian's craft. And I'll just conclude that by drawing attention. Would you mind if I just shared this brief quote right from Ehrman himself?
Oh, please.
I think this is so fascinating. It actually comes from his most recent book, How Jesus Became God, The Exaltation of a Jewish Preacher from Galilee. It's a wonderful book. And on page 147, I think our listeners will enjoy and appreciate this, because he actually mentions Mormonism in it. And he states that anyone who has presuppositions, meaning that miracles actually took place, whether it's Jesus' resurrection, Moses' parting the Red Sea, and I'm interjecting this, or the golden plates, has to silence them, back to the quote, sit on them, or else otherwise squelch them when engaging in their historical investigations. This is also true of all religious and theological beliefs that a historian happens to have. These beliefs cannot determine the outcome of a historical investigation, because they are not generally shared. This means that a historian cannot establish that the angel Moroni made revelations to Joseph Smith, as in the Mormon tradition. such views presuppose that angels exist, that Moroni is one of them, and that Joseph Smith was particularly chosen to receive a revelation from on high. These are theological beliefs. They are not based on historical evidence. Maybe there is an angel Moroni, and maybe he did reveal secret truths to Joseph Smith, but there is no way for historians to establish any of that. To do so would require accepting certain theological views that are not held by the majority of other historians, for example, those who are Roman Catholics, Reformed Jews, Buddhists, and non-religious hardcore atheists. Historical evidence has to be open to the examination by everyone of every religious belief.
Very well put.
Yes, I first listened to it on Audible and then went through and read it on my own. And when he hit that part and invoked the angel Moroni and Joseph Smith in his assessment of it, I just thought, boy, that's just something that we need to explain and help people understand. And I love that Ehrman states, you know, it's maybe there is an angel Moroni, maybe there is. Maybe there were golden plates, and maybe Joseph Smith was specifically called to do that. But those are theological beliefs and assumptions that are beyond the ability of the historian to decipher and determine, because the historian is trying to describe what most likely occurred in the past. And by definition, a miracle means something that is the least likely thing to have happened.
And I suppose that's where I think that some apologetic efforts to defend historicity of scripture and go somewhat awry is because they don't really address that issue or appreciate it in a meaningful way. In other words, they want empirical evidence to exist for the miraculous. It seems to me that Bart Ehrman, you know, hits the nail right on the head, and that is that we really don't know empirically that these things are so. And it may be an uncomfortable fact of the type of work we engage in academically, but it's a reality of the situation. Now, that's not to say that someone cannot have some type of unique faith experience that is confirmatory, and that is perfectly within the right of any human to experience what they experience and believe what they believe. But I think it's misguided to try and approach it in such a way to say that basically because the evidence for the gold plates and the witnesses is so compelling, therefore the gold plates must be real, and that there is no really reasonable alternative in understanding what may have happened, when in actual fact there could be a variety of reasonable alternatives. But within a faith context, I think it's legitimate to say that I've had an experience that I find comforting, I find confirmatory, and it's an affirmation of my beliefs. That sounds completely reasonable to me, but that's something that's in a completely different realm, in my opinion, than what the academic endeavor is in trying to understand sacred texts.
Yes, exactly. And in the understanding of sacred text in my field in biblical scholarship, we often use the term historical critical analysis. And what that means is to analyze that sacred text in its original historical context and setting, and critically, not criticizing, critiquing, or in a pejorative sense, but being critically minded, not reading the text from any contemporary theological perspectives or expectations, but instead to try and understand what was the religious message that this author hoped to convey. How did this author use the past, going back to what you talked about or asked about, Brent, in terms of the conquest narrative or the exodus out of Egypt? How is this past being conveyed to address the specific religious concerns of that author in his present circumstances? And that's really the goal.
So in that sense, criticism then is a rigorous intellectual analysis of a given data point.
Exactly.
And it's not meant at all to be pejorative, as you said. It's not negative. In fact, if anything, it's a positive. It's something that any scholar should bring to analyzing any text or any piece of information.
Yes. And it's mainstream biblical scholarship. It's the way that I teach the Bible at the University of Utah, where it's taught in other state-sponsored institutions. And And even in many progressive divinity school programs, where they expose students to ideas that may challenge the presuppositions that the student has concerning the Bible and what it is trying to accomplish, because again, the whole goal is not to take my own bias, my own presuppositions into the narrative, but to try and get into the text as it functioned in antiquity.
One of the things that I think biblical criticism brings to the forefront for an LDS audience is that there are some unique ways at looking at very familiar texts, for example, the book of Genesis and the Pentateuch as a whole. And you discuss at length the documentary hypothesis. And I'm wondering if you can give an overview for our listeners of what that entails. But what I also want you to get to is, what are the implications for the new translation of the Bible that mm-hmm. Joseph Smith was involved with, of which the Book of Moses is a selection from that, and also the Book of Abraham? What are the implications for that when we're talking about the potential of multi-authorship of the Book of Genesis, and yet the implication of single authorship for Genesis, certainly found in the opening chapters of Moses, as well as in the Book of Abraham itself?
This is really one of my primary academic interests, and that is source criticism in the Pentateuch specifically. And I appreciate that you drew attention to that work authoring the Old Testament. It was a book that I hesitated initially to publish. I wasn't quite sure that this would be the best time for me to produce that type of work. And yet, the more I thought about it, I realized this is something that was desperately needed in Mormon studies. Not that I have all the answers, but I at least wanted to expose an interested Latter-day Saint audience to the way that scholars interpret that material, and indeed its implications for our unique books of LDS scripture. Perhaps the best way to introduce an audience to that is, well, the way that I at least tried to in that book, and that is by going to the opening chapters of Genesis. It's very clear when we read Genesis chapter 1 that it's a different type of literary account from what we encounter in Genesis chapters 2 through 3. Genesis chapter 1 describes creation. God speaks and the creative acts come into being. The account consistently uses the term Elohim in Hebrew, translated as God in English. And the order of creation is very specific. As God speaks, first the plants come into being, then the animals come into being, then man and woman simultaneously in Genesis 1, 26 through 27. God then rests on the seventh day, and in Genesis chapter 2, verse 4, the first half of it, there's a conclusion to the narrative, which ties back to the very first verse. The account begins, "In the beginning, God created the heaven and the earth," and then it concludes, "These are the generations of heaven and earth when they were created." Then, all of a sudden, a new creation account is presented, and a different name for divinity is used, Yahweh in Hebrew, translated traditionally as Lord, all capital letters, the divine name Jehovah, as it's sometimes rendered. He creates by getting down and dirty. Very physical. He's an anthropomorphic God. In that sense, perhaps links with certain ideas within Mormonism. And yet the creation order is very different. First man is created, then the plants, then the animals, and finally the famous story of the creation of the woman from man's rib. And these stories are very different from one another, two totally separate views of creation. And as scholars over the years began to look at that material, they realized that segments, theologically, from a literary perspective, started to link together as they made their way carefully and critically through Genesis. For there are all sorts of repetitions and inconsistencies that need to be explained if it's just a single author creating a one entire large unified narrative. Abraham enters into two covenants, remember, with God in Genesis 15 and Genesis 17. Jacob, his grandson, he will leave home two different times and for two very different reasons. Later, as we move on, because these inconsistencies and repetitions continue, in Exodus as well. So God will reveal his name as Yahweh to Moses twice. In Exodus 3, he does this, and he does it again in Exodus chapter 6. Moses and Aaron will draw water from the rock two different times, and it continues. And the repetitions and inconsistencies seem to suggest that there are different sources involved. In fact, that's really the standard perspective that is held, I would say, universally by biblical scholars today, whether we're talking European, American, or Israeli scholars. All biblical scholars recognize that this material could not have been written by a single author, but instead is an amalgamation of separate literary sources that have been brought together in their present form. And the sources run from Genesis all the way in through Deuteronomy. The only debate that takes place in amongst Pentateuchal scholars is how much of that material then can be unified into documentary strands versus how much of it maybe is a fragmentary insertion or whatnot. But the fact that there are different sources produced by separate authors at different time points historically is something that is universally recognized today.
My first introduction to the documentary hypothesis involved the two Noachian stories. And that became a very compelling argument to me that there was more going on than just a single author sitting down and recording all of these myths and legends and so on of the Hebrew nation. But instead, you were looking at effectively the various tales and sacred literature and texts and traditions of the different tribes coming together, or I should really say the different factionalized tribes of Canaan, right? Mm-hmm. That when they are coming together, they're each bringing their own tribal traditions and they're getting worked out in this way. Is that how you would see it, or do you have another take on that?
No, I very much see it that way. And I do, as I explained in the book, subscribe to a documentary perspective. In terms of these sources, most Israeli and North American scholars today, I believe that we're talking about four separate documents that have been brought together. I believe that the earliest one was produced in the northern kingdom of Israel, at least probably initially about the mid-8th century BCE. And scholars refer to that as the E source because it traditionally uses the name Elohim as the divine name. Then the second source from my perspective historically is what is known as J. That's the one that uses Jehovah or Yahweh in Genesis 2 through 3. And that one's I would probably date to about the 8th through maybe the 7th centuries BCE, and that's produced in the southern kingdom. Then we have the priestly document, which is Genesis chapter 1 through 2:4a that I mentioned before. And that priestly narrative is probably at least the initial stage of it, maybe the 6th century. And yet most scholars, myself included, are convinced that it's not finished until the exilic time period in 586 when the Jews are taken captive into Babylon. And then that final documentary source is basically Deuteronomy, known as D, and that's produced in the 7th century. Now, these are rough estimates in terms of the dating. I think there are compelling reasons to adopt them, but it's very important for those who are exposed to these ideas to recognize that what we may go back and forth in terms of our understanding of the dating and the relative relationship of this material to one another, the fact that we have separate sources produced by different scribes at different time period is absolutely beyond a hypothesis. It seems to be, it gives the wrong impression. It's something that is very well established in scholarship as a fact that has to be explained or accounted for.
So going back to Mormon scripture and talking about the New Translation and the Book of Abraham, what does that mean for those works and the way we understand them?
Well, specifically with Abraham, it means that from a historical perspective and what we know about the material that shows up in the Book of Abraham, that it is impossible to attribute it to Abraham himself. And it really, even if we set aside documentary analysis for just a second, and just if we think about this critically for a moment, when would the material that tells the story of ancient Israel, its rise and who they are and their relationship to the other people around them, when would text like that have been written by scribes? You're not going to write those narratives and stories when they're traveling around in the wilderness and they're a bunch of loose family clans and, you know, tribal connections. You're not going to develop that material at that time period. You're going to develop that after you're established as a community in the land, and you can step back and catch your breath, and you actually have something to say about who we are, where we came from, and how we got to be in this present circumstance or situation. It just makes sense. And not only that, but we can actually see the influence and imprint of Mesopotamian sources that the Judean and Israelite scribes are interacting with because of the time period in which this material was produced, when you have divided monarchies that are subjects to the Assyrians, to the Babylonians. I discuss much of this in my book. So again, this means that the material that is adopted and put into the actual hand of Abraham as if he wrote it simply is anachronistic and cannot be dated back that far to him as a authorial figure. For example, of the sources that I referred to, Abraham will treat Genesis chapter 1 and 2 as if it's one unified narrative produced not by Judean scribes later on in Israelite history, but instead by Abraham himself. And it even goes further than that, and I discuss that point in my book, but when I put that forward, some people who recognize the validity of documentary analysis then tried to, well, they, at least I was asked the question. I said, well, they asked, well, what if maybe that was just inserted and Abraham is responsible for all the rest of the material? But we can't go that direction either, because even, for example, Abraham chapter 2, verse 3, it's going to talk about Abraham, and God is going to tell him directly, Abraham, get thee out of thy country, from thy kindred, and from thy father's house, and unto a land that I will show thee. And that's connected with Genesis chapter 12, verse 1, which is where it comes from. It stems from that, and that's a J source. And later on in chapter 2, well, about verse 14 or so forth, we'll read, so I, Abraham, departed as the Lord had said unto me, and Lot with me. Now that's the end of the J section in Genesis chapter 12, where we read that, so Abram departed as the Lord had spoken unto him, and Lot went with him. And then you have the book of Abraham continue, and it's going to do so by adopting another documentary tradition. It's going to adopt the P source to create that next part, where Abraham was 75 years old when he departed out of Haran, and Abram took his wife Sarai with him, and Lot and his brothers. And so we see it's not just the creation narrative, it's really the entire book, with the exception of some of the unique parts that are added about premortal existence, intelligences. But the basic story of Abraham is going to draw upon documentary traditions and put them together as if it's a single narrative that, again, today we recognize come from separate historical sources produced by Judean scribes.
Perhaps complicating that even more is that there are some unique things that occur within Mormon theology during that time period that also show up in very interesting ways. For example, in the Book of Moses, when it talks about the rivers that are associated with the Garden of Eden, it's very clear in their description that it places them in the Old World. But by 1838, Joseph Smith had already begun discussing the location of Adam on Diamond and the original Garden of Eden and placing them in Jackson County, Missouri. So now when we get to the location of the rivers that are mentioned in the Book of Abraham, they become very obscure and no longer make clear references to the Old World. It's that type of thing that even complicates it to another level, right? So we already have the issue with the documentary hypothesis, but now we also have added to that Joseph Smith's evolving theology and understanding of where these locations were in antiquity as they relate to the creation narrative, and the narratives are changing to adapt to that. I don't think that those things can be ignored any more than the documentary hypothesis in the context of that. And we get back to the issue of what exactly are these documents, and do they reflect Joseph Smith's development of theology? Are they vehicles for Joseph Smith's developing theology, or are they something else?
Yes, and that's wonderful analysis. I would also add, they clearly reflect, at least specifically the Book of Abraham, it's clearly going to reflect Joseph Smith's working with Hebrew. He's going to adopt the Hebrew that he is learning from Joshua Satius in the School of the Prophets, and we see that incorporated into his translations, his interpretation, and development of the material. So what is Joseph Smith doing? He's drawing upon his exposure, I believe, to Messianic lore. He's drawing upon his attempt to interpret the King James Version of the Bible. I think a legitimate effort on his part to try and decipher what the hieroglyphics mean that he has in his possession. And again, then working with Hebrew, he's bringing all of this material together to create this fascinating book that is the Book of Abraham.
That's very well put, because in point of fact, the material that is influenced the most in terms of the Hebrew classes that were taken in the School of the Prophets are all in sections that are being translated, dictated after they actually have the class. So a portion of the text, the opening chapters of the Book of Abraham, are dictated prior to the Hebrew class and show virtually no influence from the Hebrew studies. But then you go to chapter 3 and you see very heavy influence from the Hebrew studies, as well as in the interpretations of, for example, facsimile number 2. The Hyphocephalus, you see very direct influence from the Hebrew classes in those instances. So it's not until he actually takes the Hebrew classes that the influence occurs in the Book of Abraham. And I think that that's an important point to note as well.
That's fascinating. I wasn't aware of that historical element. I'd looked at it from the perspective of comparing the Book of Abraham and how Hebrew is adopted and used in the production of that source, as opposed to the earlier Book of Moses, which shows no sign of it in its in terms of its development. But to take it in the direction that you did, and a more careful look intrinsically at the Book of Abraham, that's fascinating, Brent. That's that.
Yeah,
I love that.
It's an interesting study to see when certain things come into Joseph Smith's worldview and how he expands on them. And I refer to this once as prophetic eclecticism, where Joseph Smith had a propensity to take things around him and to recreate them into a new revelatory theological experience. And I think if, you know, from just a purely naturalistic point of view, I think that that's one of the genius elements in what Joseph Smith could accomplish. You know, I wonder too then, what is the ultimate understanding of what his scriptural texts would be if they're not all historical? And I'm even leaving aside for right now the issues which are very complex in relating to the Book of Mormon. But if we look at a text like the Book of Abraham and we say that this is not a work that was actually written by Abraham himself, what is a text like this? How should we understand a text like this, in your opinion?
I had, and I won't name the individual, but I had recently a wonderful conversation with a dear friend, a famous figure in Mormon studies, very much a believer. And this particular scholar, we were discussing the Book of Abraham, and this scholar said, "What if Joseph Smith is just up there saying, my gosh, you guys canonized that? I was just messing around trying to figure out what that was. And you turned it into scripture and then said, you know, boy, I want, maybe we should just take the Book of Abraham out of the canon, or at least the facsimiles." And, you know, just talking openly about this. And I said to this person, I said, "Oh, I hope not. I hope we never take it out of the canon. I love it as a person of religious faith, one who feels connected with divinity through this material. I think it's fascinating to see what Joseph Smith is doing with the various sources that he has in his environment and his culture to produce something so, from my perspective, inspired in terms of its theological constructs and its ability to link his own revelations with the past, and therefore take this central figure within Judaism, within Islam, within Christianity, Abraham, and actualize that person in an LDS context. And in my book, I use the term, I link it with creation ex nihilo. And I think this is helpful to an LDS audience because, of course, Joseph Smith is going to reject the traditional Jewish Christian perspective of creation out of nothing, and he'll say that God doesn't work that way. Instead, God takes pre-existent material that exists in the cosmos and gives it order, gives it structure. So for those of us who are open, who are believing Latter-day Saints and yet are open to a critical assessment of what this material really is, an amalgamation of Joseph Smith's working with Hebrew, his attempts to decipher the Egyptian hieroglyphics in his possession, his work with messianic lore, taking all of these sources and creating something new, he's simply imitating God's creative process from a religious perspective.
That's a really interesting take, and you've inspired me to get somewhat geeky on you now and talk about a Star Trek episode that I saw years ago now, where Lieutenant Worf, who's a Klingon, is teaching a bunch of kids about their Klingon past and Klingon lore, and in specifically talking about Kalis, who effectively founded the Klingon warrior civilization. And during the course of him reciting these, you know, just amazing tales, one of the listeners, you know, pipes up and says, "You're making all this up." And he says, "I am not making any of this up. These stories tell us who we are." Well, after this, his love interest, or who becomes his love interest, later asks him, "Are the stories true?" And he responds and says, "I find new truth in them every day." Putting aside our Star Trek analogy now, I almost look at this and say, is this a type of root metaphor? Is this something where we're looking at that it matters more the experience that Joseph Smith had with God in revealing these types of things, more than it does in the actual trying to understand the historicity of every element within these types of work? Does that make sense?
Yeah, almost thou convinced. Okay. To be a Star Trek fan. I mean, that is, I think that's very profound, and it's certainly true. And one thing I like to emphasize with people as I discuss this is that this perspective about Joseph Smith's scripture and how he produces it ties in very nicely with the way that scripture in the Bible is brought together, whether it's Hebrew Bible or the New Testament. Classic illustration of this would be Matthew's use of the Hebrew Bible. He is going to constantly cite references from Isaiah and other locations and point to it as, use it as a springboard by which to understand Jesus. For example, he will talk about Isaiah's famous prophecy regarding the young woman who will have a child. And contextually, it's very clear that Isaiah is referring to Hezekiah's birth. And that's why the birth to a young woman at that time period, who, and the child who will grow up, and before he reaches the age of accountability, the foreign powers that surround Ahaz, the king of Judah, will be brought low, will be a sign that Isaiah's counsel is correct and should be accepted. It has a very specific historical meaning that we can decipher through historical critical analysis. It had nothing to do with Jesus's birth or prophecy, but that's okay. Matthew takes it and he uses it as a springboard to actualize and make relevant his understanding of spirituality and who Jesus is because of this earlier sacred text. Isaiah, the writings in Isaiah will do the exact same thing. Scholars are convinced that there are at least three major sections written during different historical time periods for the book of Isaiah. First Isaiah, which more or less runs from chapter 1 through 39, then Deutero-Isaiah, which picks up in chapter 40, which is written during the exile. And then finally in 56 through 66, the end of the book, third Isaiah, which is written after the Jews come back from Babylon. It's very clear, not only from the Hebrew, but the themes, the ideas, the historical background to the material, that that's what's taking place in that book. And later portions of Isaiah will cite earlier segments of the real, authentic Isaiah, take those out of context, but use those as a springboard to make relevant that scriptural text to the present community at that time period. And this is the same thing. Not only does it happen in the Hebrew Bible and in the New Testament, but that's what Josephus does, the first century Jewish historian. He will, in essence, rewrite the Bible and add new material to it. Philo of Alexandria, the Hellenized Jew who lives during the same time period in Alexandria, Egypt, he'll do the same thing, mixing the Hebrew Bible and adding on Platonic philosophy to create new sacred literature. So when we interpret Joseph Smith's work along those lines, there is actually a very nice parallel for the development of all scripture, at least from a Jewish and Christian perspective, that we can make with Mormonism.
In essence, if an ancient prophet or an ancient writer of sacred literature can rewrite another sacred text, why not a modern prophet or a modern writer of sacred literature?
Yes. And it's a much more, I'd say, accurate understanding, not only of Joseph Smith, but specifically of the Bible. And I think that as religious individuals, that we should look for accuracy and use our mind to critically assess this material. And then once we've done that, then try to use that assessment to understand our own personal relationship to the divine. To me, that's a much healthier way of approaching this, but probably a much more spiritual way of approaching it than turning a blind eye to reasoned critical analysis and what seems to be historical
David,
reality.
David, you are a wise man, and I appreciate those insights. Those are just absolutely brilliantly put, well articulated, and this is something that clearly resonates with you, something that you've thought about, and you are a profound expositor of these ideas. Thank you so much for spending this time with me. I do plan on having you back. You threaten from time to time that you are done with Mormon studies, but I'm just not gonna. I'm not gonna let
it
happen.
It could be a frustrating.
So you will be hearing more from me. You've got much to offer, and thank you so much for joining me for this episode. There is much more for us to discuss in the future.
Brent, you are always so kind, and I am really grateful for a chance to share these ideas. I am very passionate about them. They mean a lot to me, and I'm grateful for all of your efforts that you've done over the years. You're an inspiration to many of us, myself specifically, and the contributions that you've made have been so important, and now to branch into a podcast where we can have open conversations from different perspectives and approach this material historically, critically, devotionally, under your direction. I'm thrilled. So thank you
and
very
thank
much.
You,
you're very kind,
David. You're very kind as well. And again, we will have you back. I've said this to everyone I've interviewed thus far, all three of you, and I'm absolutely committed to it. There are so many voices out there who have so much to offer, and you are at the top of my list. So thank you again, my friend.
Thank you.